everyone, and welcome along to the Colchester Arts Centre Never Knowingly Understood podcast. My name's Tim Morgan. This is episode number 6, Indie and Beyond. Now, I was very lucky to catch up with Roddy Woomble from Idlewild, who will be performing here on Tuesday, the 2nd of May. So here we are.
Have you played in Colchester before? Have you been to the Arts Centre?
Oh yeah, a few times. I say solo, but I always play with someone. I'm not a solo performer in that way. So this time Andrew Mitchell's accompanying me. He's a multi-instrumentalist that plays with me. And I played in Colchester Arts Centre with my solo band, I think probably about 10 years ago, about 2013. And that was when I had a 4-piece band, and it was kind of a bit more, I suppose, a bit more folky. So that was a different thing from the way of what I do now. I'm in Idlewild, the band that I am singing occasionally. we've played in Colchester Arts Centre a couple of times.
Good.
And the last one being before Glastonbury in 2003, so 20 years ago. We did a warm up in Colchester Arts Centre and then drove to Glastonbury.
And in terms of what you'll be playing now, is it predominantly going to be low soul, or is it going to kind of be a mixture of your kind of solo works? Or
it's mainly solo works. I mean, I do, obviously, I'm not under no illusion. A lot of people are coming because they're Idlewild fans. I mean, I have played solo gigs for the past 15 years, so I do have, it is a different crowd almost. But at the same time, I like singing Idlewild songs and the crowd like hearing them. So I always, you know, intersperse all my solo work with that kind of thing. Yeah. I mean, I suppose my solo work has kind of been quite sort of schizophrenic in a way that it's kind of changed from things to one style to the, maybe that's not the best expression, but, you know, it's changed from one style to the other. It's been like, you know, I guess originally a kind of folk acoustic based music. Mm-hmm. And then it moved more into, I guess, more of a country feel with Listen to Keep. And then by the time of the Deluder, there was almost no guitars on it. It was all kind of synth based and kind of darker and more introspective. And then now it's largely electronic, because through the pandemic, I got into a way of working where basically I live in the Hebrides, which is quite a remote part of Scotland. And during the pandemic, you couldn't go anywhere. Obviously, everyone was in the same situation. And I started working just via, you know, online with the people I collaborate with. And that really suited me in the way that, but obviously it made it difficult to kind of sound like a band, if you know what I mean, because we were recording everything separately. So that's sort of what I've got a new record now that I'm almost finished. So it's sort of it's a kind of in between tours, in between albums sort of tour. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
Low Soul came out 2 years ago, and I've got a new one that's not going to come out probably till later in the year. So it's sort of, but at the same time, I just like to play gigs, partly to, you know, explore all the songs and be creative, but also, you know, that's how me and Andrew make our living as well. So we try to do as many gigs as we can. So it's just really nice to get a chance to get in the car and travel around and play some songs for a week.
And the new album that you're working on, is that going to be sort of have the kind of electronic thing, or is this going to be more, I mean, what sort of direction is it going in?
Oh, it's definitely more electronic, actually. But at the same time, I say that not in a way that would alienate anyone that liked my work previously. Because what ties it in is always my voice and my sense of sort of, I'm a melodicist, so it's always a sense of melody. I've always got good tunes, and I'm really interested in words and poetry and things like that. So I take a lot of time over that aspect of it. And therefore, I think that people who like any of my solo work can find that connection in it, even if the music is, you know, more minimal and more electronic than, you know, some of the records. It's like I say, have like acoustic guitars and violins and stuff on them. What's interesting to me is where I can place the words. I mean, I'm really interested in the words, you know, and the context that surrounds them.
Yeah.
And that's why I like making solo records, probably more than in a band context now. I'm very grateful for all the things that the band brought, you know, in terms of experiences. And largely, like, when you're in a band, you're known for that sound, you know what I mean? Whereas under my own name, I feel like I can kind of explore quite a lot of different sounds.
Do the kind of lyrics change? I mean, when your first solo album, My Secret Is My Silence, now that's very different to Idlewild in terms of the sound and the instrumentation. I mean, as you say, the melody. But, I mean, did you find just... was that always the intention to make an album that was more kind of steeped in maybe more of the kind of traditional kind of folky type sound? Or
yeah, I mean, around that time, that would have been 2005. We wrote that record. Or I wrote that record, and yeah, I was interested in making Idlewild a bit more. We'd sort of touched upon that with the album Warnings and Promises, when we'd had like string section and a female backing vocalist and pedal steel, and a little changes from the sort of rock band setup is what we were kind of known for, and I was quite keen to do more of that, but then the band really weren't, so that's why I went and did my own record, and I went the other extreme. Obviously, I had it mainly as mainly acoustic and mainly kind of I guess a folk album really, and it proved to be quite popular with people. I mean, I think it was because I had that, like you said, I had that melodic sense that people liked about Idlewild, and Rod Jones, the guitar player in Idlewild, was very involved in My Secret Is My Silence too. So it wasn't a million miles away from an Idlewild record, really. It was just like basically an acoustic album. So, I think, yeah. But then subsequently, all the records I've made after that, solo records, no one from Idlewild's been involved in them, and it's been much more down its own path, But My Secret Is My Silence is essentially like the lost Idlewild album.
And were you, I don't know if surprised is the right word, but were you expecting the kind of reception that it received? Because it did tremendously well, and I suspect it probably won you a new audience as well.
It did and it didn't. I mean, like, to be honest, it was like, it got a 5-star review in the Times. I remember Sunday Times, I remember reading that, thinking, wow, this is like, people really are responding. But then the next week it got a 1-star review in Q magazine, which arguably at the time was more of an influential thing for music fans. Yeah, it was like the guy, quite often in reviews, you feel that people haven't really listened to it. Mm. Clearly, the review sounded like he listened to a song and thought, this is shit, and then put it off. But yeah, so I kind of mixed it. And then same with fans of the band. At that point, fans of the band were like, I don't like this. I don't like this fact, the fact that he's becoming like a acoustic troubadour rather than being a front man in this band, this rock band. So it wasn't like a commercial, smash and a critical smash. It was like, what's really nice about that record is over time, it's grown to this kind of like, I guess like a cult classic or whatever you want to call it. Like people really, people who like it, love it. It's one of those records that you can't really, it just sort of ends up that way. You can't plan it like that. So, and when we play the songs now, they sound like sort of like, they sound as established as songs as when we play, American English or any of the well-known Idlewild songs. They feel like they're well-known songs now, which is really cool.
Slightly later on, or I don't know if it was a little bit later on, moving to Mull and a small kind of a much smaller sort of island community. Did that kind of influence your writing from that point?
Yes, it did. Well, I mean, there was a lot of changes around that time. I mean, 2008, 2009, 2010. So, my son was born then, moved to Mull from the city. The band Idlewild took a hiatus, which at the time was, we didn't know how long that was going to be for. Could be, 3 years, 10 years, whatever. And I saw a lot of changes in my life in a positive way. I wanted to carry on making records, and that was the way I knew that I could, like, contribute something to the world and also like make a living. So yeah, I started to make records in Mull, a local art centre, which is a little recording studio, just with local musicians. And many of them were actually amazing people, well, are amazing people and brilliant musicians. So it was quite lucky in that way. And then that's the records that came from that were The Impossible Songs and other songs. And then one called Listen to Keep. And then after that, that's when Idlewild 2015 started making music again. So, yeah, that whole period was really, it was, I mean, like, on paper, it sounds quite romantic and, because it was an old cottage from, 1850, I think it was built. Didn't have any heating. They had, like, fires in the rooms. And we had, like, I bought an old boat and I had a vegetables plot and kept chicken. It was that kind of life, Yeah. Really nice, but also has its challenge, and it's very isolated, and but at the same time, I like my own company. I feel very comfortable, when I'm alone in a room, so it sort of suits me. But I don't live in that house anymore now. I live actually on the island of Iona, which is closer, which has got more of a community, and it's like a really lovely place to be. But that 5 years in a sort of more of a remote spot was quite, it was definitely seeped into all the music I made at that time.
I mean, how do you structure a song? Is it, do the lyrics come first, or is there kind of something that you take inspiration from, or?
Oh, it just depends, really. I mean, I work with people. Largely, I don't compose on my own. Sometimes I do. I did a lot in the pandemic because I had to be on my own. Yeah. I'm not a very good guitar player, though, so I just, like, I do it. It's very basic. It just depends. My preferred way is to sit in a room with someone and just bash, you know, just splurge out ideas. Try and get as many things down in one afternoon as you can, even if it's just like 20-second bits, melody ideas and stuff, and then I piece them all together. That's the bit I enjoy, actually. It's sort of like a jigsaw puzzle, or, you know, editing it together. The creative act is really in editing almost sometimes. That's the way I prefer to write them, and then to build on that. But, you know, there's loads of other ways we've done. And, you know, because I've worked with so many people over my, you know, kind of recording career, every individual's got a different take on it. It's quite a weird thing to do, to write songs with people, to write songs in general. So everyone's got their very particular way they are, which is quite an interesting thing to observe too, when you're being able to kind of witness other people's working methods. I like the fact that there is no, it's still a mystery, you know, there's still no way. And all these songwriting courses and university things on it, I just think that's a lot of rubbish, because it's like, it's one of these few things you can't really teach. I mean, you can teach someone song structure and you can be a brilliant musician. That doesn't mean you're going to write a good song necessarily.
Have you written songs for other people at all, or are they all, other than obviously the band, have you written songs that other people?
No. Well, I've done a few things like that. Like once a guy came up, he was like a model, a male model, and he had like a management company. They wanted me to write some songs with him. He was a really lovely man, but we did some songs. But that world is pretty mad. You know, I've got friends that do that. And it's like you have to pitch your ideas at conferences with thousands of other songwriters that are also trying to get that song, you know, that gig, that song on this pop star's record, you know. So that's not my idea of, that's not my idea. That's not why I write songs. All right, so rock songs are like I always wanted to be an artist of some type, when I was younger. And the songwriting's the way it worked out, you know, for me. It's my form of artistic expression. So,
Do you have like a song that you have written that maybe means more than any of the other songs? I don't know if that's probably the right way of describing it. Is there one that kind of means,
like, your favorite, you mean?
Yeah, I guess.
No, not really. I mean, like, I have, like, you know, when we play I Do Well gigs, which doesn't happen hardly ever, but when we play songs like You Held the World in Your Arms or Little Discouraged or songs like that, they just unify the whole crowd in a way that is kind of mad to watch and lovely to watch. How, you know, suddenly how many people you're playing to, 1,000 or whatever, they're all in that moment with that song, and they're all living out their experiences of that song when it happened in their life, you know. And that's an amazing thing to see, to have these kind of songs that can unify people like that in a way in a gig. Solo songs, obviously, I play in much smaller places, and it's more seated and much more kind of, I guess, reflective. It's kind of a relaxed night out for the crowd. And so, I mean, and therefore I listen, I enjoy singing them all, because you can really, like, you know, I guess with rock shows and stuff, it's like high energy and there's nervousness, and it's over before you've even thought about it, you know. And that's what's quite good about playing sort of more smaller, low-key kind of solo shows. You can really think about the songs as you're singing them. So no, I don't have any favorites. I mean, I think always my favorite thing is the thing I'm working on now, because that's the truest reflection of who I am now. So I would say the new songs I'm working on now are the favorite things that I've done. But at the same time, you know, I've got lots of interesting songs to choose when we play concerts.
And what about kind of influences? Your kind of musical influences, how have they changed since, you know, kind of the inception of Idlewild, or even pre that? I mean, what kind of motivated you or made you desire to kind of be in a band, I guess?
Like I was saying there, like, I always wanted to be an artist, and I was originally thought I was going to be, I was really like painting. And I thought, but then I got into photography and film, and that's what I ended up doing at university. But I always played in bands since I was 14, mainly as a drummer. And then when I moved to Edinburgh to study photography, that's when I met all the other guys in the band, and Colin already played the drums. So I just decided to go and, because I'd always written the words in the bands I'd been in, because, you know, a lot of people aren't really interested in writing or reading. And I was, so I was always delegated. That was my job, was to write the song words. So I started doing that. And when you can focus on something all the time, you can really get into it, you know. So as soon as the band started being quite a serious band, and, you know, we started putting out records and stuff, I could devote all my time to basically reading and writing. And that's kind of, I realized that's like the way I wanted to spend my life. And I've tried to do that ever since. Influences have changed, obviously, over the years massively, from, you know, a lot of punk rock bands and underground American rock bands, like, you know, Fugazi, Minor Threat, Black Flag, that whole Replacements, you know, that whole world when we started, that's what I was interested in. And, you know, like going through, you know, music is an education, so one thing leads to another, doesn't it? So,
yes, yeah.
You know, you go end up like going down. I love listening to jazz now, and, like, you know, lots of different types of music I never listened to in my 20s. And some of the, like, a lot of electronic music, it's not something that interests me at all in my 20s and 30s, but, you know, one thing leads to another musically, and you just think, it's just forms of expression, isn't it? You realize that, God, everyone's doing the same thing in their own way. And that's pretty interesting to be able to kind of try out.
And thank you to Roddy for that rather fascinating interview. And hopefully you can get along on Tuesday, the 2nd of May. And next up is the resident art centre guru, Mick the Hippie, who will be choosing his favourite selection of acts that are coming up in the month of May.
Mick's picks then for May. Well, the main one's got to be Tuesday the 9th, which is a classic horror night, Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter. You just know it's going to be good. Then, of course, there are all of the wonderful Wednesdays, all worth a look, all different. You never know what you're going to get. And a whole bunch of sold out comedy. That's it. Enjoy.
And thank you to Mick for his picks there for the month of May. And next up is some indie royalty. Now, we have here on Thursday the 18th of May, The Wedding Present. And David Gedge, we managed to get for an interview. And this interview was done by a special guest star. So Dancer Dave from Colne Radio stepped in when I was unavailable and has done a mighty fine interview. So over to the two Daves.
So you're looking forward to the new tour. So coming up, you'll be playing at the Colchester Arts Centre quite soon. You've got the tour coming up. You're doing the 24 songs tour, where you've been recording a double A-side a month throughout 2022, which was kind of harking back to the 18 top 40 singles you had on the you previously done the Hit Parade series in the 90s. So
it was kind of a little, because it was 1992 when we did the 12 singles. Because it was 2022 last year, I felt like that we should do some kind of anniversary of it in some way, first anniversary. And then I just decided that, you know, we might as well just do it again, really, you know, it was such a good thing to do. And I've always liked 7-inch singles, you know, I've always, format and stuff, because we grew up with them, didn't we? It was like, you know, you heard a song on the radio, you went to the shop, you bought a 7-inch single,
absolutely. Still got, and also kind of, the C86 stuff. You were sort of a kind of a C86 band, you know, with the NME used to bring the cassettes out, which had, you know, I still like the old tapes. I still play cassettes occasionally.
Cassettes were fine. I always thought it was weird when kind of cassettes got phased out, because I thought it was a really good format, because you could take stuff off the radio, you could take your records, you could play it in the car, you know.
And the old sort of John Peel days, where you sort of record sort of tracks, you know, you could get all these tracks, and John Peel used to leave a bit of space so you could, you know, you wouldn't talk over them. So when you recorded the Hit Parade series and the 24 songs, did you have a lot of it in the bank beforehand? How much of it was written and recorded over the course of the year in 92 and obviously last year?
Well, the first time we did it, actually not very much, because we only had the idea, and I think it was like November of 1991. We just thought, you know, we had a few songs, maybe like three or four, and we thought, you know, we're going to work towards, you know, the next LP or whatever. And it was our bass player, Keith, actually, at the time. And he just said, because he was a member of the Sub Pop Singles Club, the label from Seattle. They used to do like a 7-inch every month. And he just said, we could do that, you know, as a band. Right? And then we just thought, what an amazing idea that would be. So we kind of, it started then, really. We went in and recorded the songs we had. And then we did it in four sessions, during the next 12 months. It's a lot easier in those days, though, because obviously the turnaround, the vinyl is crazy. I don't know, to get like a record press these days, it's like 6 months, especially because it was on RCA at the time. So we were literally, in the studio, recording the songs, mixing them, and they were, out like, 6 weeks later.
Nice.
Wouldn't happen now. It was a lot quicker in those days. So we didn't have anything planned in those days, but this time we had to be a bit more kind of, it was planned in advance because of that kind of vinyl production thing. So we started doing it, I guess, about 6 months before. So the summer of 2021, recording, and then again we did it in four batches.
Yeah,
because we kept touring and doing other stuff as well, and then. Writing songs as we went along, and then when we had another six or whatever, we'd go in the studio and
that's great, because the first time around with the original Hit Parade series, so you're a record breaking band for being the only band to have 12 top 40 singles in 1 year, and you
not the only band.
You drew with Elvis.
Well, I was going to say, because Elvis did it as well.
Yeah, but yours were all original, so you win.
Well, yeah, but I think he sold quite a few million more than we did. So.
But that's nothing to do with it. That's nothing to do with creativity, is it?
He was on RCA as well, which is a little kind of a
marketing. How do you feel about the RCA years? So, obviously back in the day, there was some talk, some people thought it was a bit of a sellout, but then again, sold out. You didn't start doing pop music.
So. If anything, we were even more extreme, more alternative when we were on RCA. Yeah. We had
freedom, didn't you?
We had total freedom. We had total artists. I mean, that's the reason we signed to them, because we spoke to pretty much every major label at the time, because on the success of George Best, which we'd done on our own label, people kind of came in and said, sign to MCA or Polydor or whatever. And RCA were the only ones who said, to their credit, okay, we just carry on the way you've been working. We'll just put the records out. Put that in writing. And it was quite a kind of mold-breaking contract for a band at our level at that time. It was
the
kind of contract, Annie Lennox would have, or Elvis Presley would have, or whatever. But, for a new band, it was quite free. So, we had total artistic control, marketing control.
It made sense for you to go to a big label, because that must have been a real nice touch when the success of George Best on your own label. I mean, that's something that doesn't often happen, does it?
We didn't sell them around the world because it was our own label, and it was a little label in Britain. So signing to RCA meant finally, we used to get so many letters from people saying, we can't get the records in America or, Europe or whatever. And RCA, obviously, international company. But then, the first release we did on RCA was a collection of Ukrainian folk music. So it wasn't the most commercial. Yeah.
But that's great, though. I was interested in that because, as a music fan, I like to listen to everything in the world, and I'm always interested in something different. So what was it called? It was called Ukransky Vitupi v. Jean Appeal. Is that roughly right?
Ukrainian
Peter Soloka, your ex-guitarist, that was his heritage when he had Ukrainian heritage.
Yeah, exactly. His dad was Ukrainian, and he was kind of interested in the music just to play it to me. And often, the beauty of doing John Peel sessions is you could do anything you want, really. You've got to come in and do certain things. In fact, the first time we did it, it was a normal wedding present Peel session, and we just kind of did one at the end, just messing around. And we thought we could do a whole session of this, really.
Ended up doing three.
Yeah, we did three. Did we do three?
Yeah.
Three or four, I can't remember now. But it was... But then, as I say, RCA, to their credit, released them.
Yeah.
So that was, it wasn't, the most obvious commercial, thing to do, really.
Not at all. But then again, that's been the key to your longevity, is the fact that you haven't done the obvious and the commercial and what's going to sell. You've genuinely kept it real.
Kind of on purpose, though, I didn't plan to be willfully kind of perverse. It's just the way it's happened.
Yeah.
Really.
And also just coming up with interesting things to do, just doing something original and something, just coming out with
something. I've always thought, for me, I'm a big fan of pop music in general, but also pop culture. And I kind of think it's more than just, you know, writing a few songs and making a record. It's good to do different things. It's good to kind of, you know, test yourself and these strange projects, you know, like the Hit Parade and 24 Songs, I suppose.
Yeah.
So we've
got, pushing, you know, yourself as well, really. So you were formed in 1985 from the ashes of the Lost Pandas, immediately started releasing singles in 85. So straight away. And I read a story somewhere about you getting a coach with like 500 copies of your debut single to give to a distributor. So you had that sort of that DIY sort of ethos, that sort of.
I mean, also we had no money, so that was
the fact you did it so quickly. You know, you were formed in 85, and straight away you've got singles out.
Because the Lost Pandas were kind of almost like the wedding present in waiting, really. And that was the main band I was in for a couple of years in the kind of early 80s. But two of them left and went to live in America, actually. The kind of basis of the wedding present was already there. We just needed to find a drummer and a bass player, and then...
Because also I was interested in the Cinerama stuff you did, you know, sort of influenced by sort of soundtrack. I love a soundtrack. I've got a bit of vinyl behind me. I do love a soundtrack. And say Ennio Morricone and the John Barry stuff. I mean, I love all that old stuff on vinyl. Mm. So I'd say the earlier stuff with... Cinemara was more influenced by that, but then it kind of went more wedding presently. Do you think that's fair to say? And the first album was Spanish, sung in Spanish. So you're Spanish speaker yourself then?
No, I'm not.
but that was you singing in Spanish though.
It was, yeah. But
it did pretty well for if you don't speak Spanish.
I think I'm quite good at kind of mimicking, you know, me. Because obviously there's a Spanish, I can't remember when we did, because I've done a couple of Spanish things actually, and it's been different people, but I think when we did the Cinerama stuff, that it was recorded in America, and Steve Albini studio actually, and I said, you know anybody who speaks Spanish, and he happened to know this person who, I think she was a Spanish teacher or something, so she came in and kind of guided me, so she would kind of tell me a line, and then I'd say, okay, I've got it, and then he pressed the record, and I'd sing that line. And then he'd press stop and he'd tell me. So it was like that. It was like
my line. See, yeah. It was a foolproof way of
Welsh
doing it.
As well. When we did, what was it? I think it was Valentina, the album. I did four tracks in German, four tracks in French, and four tracks in Welsh. And Welsh was really difficult, actually, because it's kind of putting your mouth into these weird shapes.
Yeah, So have you got any Welsh blood? I've heard you're interested, you know, you've got a love for all things Welsh. Have you got any Welsh heritage yourself?
No, not at all. It was just it was just a whim I had, really. I wanted to do, weirdly, I wanted to do French, German, Welsh and Japanese, and then do these like three, four track EPs. And we never got around to the Japanese one because I think that was probably a bridge too far for me. But the Welsh one, I've always loved the sound of Welsh. It's an amazing sound. It's a very kind of musical kind of sounding language. And it was actually, I don't know how I met him, but there's an actor who's in the Welsh soap opera called, I think it's called Pobl y Cwm.
Right.
And he's a wedding present fan. And he said, well, if you want to do so, I'll translate it with you. Again, he sort of coached me with the pronunciation as we were recording it. So I don't know why I do these things sometimes, because I just make a load of work for myself.
But why not? Why not?
But interesting.
But by making a challenge, then you've got to step up to it. It's easy to, you know, it's easy to end up doing less if you're not, you know, you set yourself these challenges, like, you know, so, you know, 12 or 24 singles in a year. Yeah, so you've had numerous lineups over the years. So am I right in saying your current lineup, The Wedding Present, is yourself, obviously, Nicholas Weller on drums, John Stewart on guitars, and Melanie Howard bass since 2018. Is that?
That is the correct lineup, yes.
So that's who you'll be touring with this year for the 24 Songs tour.
We will be, yeah.
But that sounds great, the 24 Songs package. So you've got like a coloured vinyl, is it triple album, like a box set?
Well, that's the weird thing, because it's like, you know, obviously we're going to compile them, all the singles. And when we did it last time in the Hit Parade, it actually went on two 12-inch LPs, so it was a double LP with 12 songs, 12 tracks on each LP. But this time, because some of the tracks are longer, it wouldn't fit on. So it was always going to be like sort of two and a half LPs, I guess. And I thought, well, you know, there's extra tracks hanging around that we haven't, we did a single a couple of years ago, and we did a track for a Ukrainian benefit album. So we thought, let's stick them all on. And it became this, you know, expanded to this triple album. It sounds a bit progressive.
Turned into, No, a box set. No, that's nice though. Yeah, that's something nice to put out, especially with a coloured vinyl. Yeah, possibility. That sounds. Yeah.
Well, I spoke to our distributor, and because normally we always, you know, what we've always done in the past is mainly kind of black vinyl, and then we, you know, we do some like coloured vinyl as a special thing, maybe for the independent shops or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It's always. You're trying to work out how many you do of each. And he just said, just do all coloured because everybody likes coloured vinyl. Nobody really cares about black vinyl anymore, which I was quite surprised because I always thought black vinyl had a better audio quality, but apparently that's a myth. So
yeah, I think so. I think some of the picture discs, I think, used to be a bit moody back in the day, didn't they? You know, when you had the actual photograph on the sleeve. But yeah, as far as coloured vinyl, I suppose there's no reason why not. And it's nice to have it back in it, I think. Actually, no, nice
just stuff. Paint to have on tour, to be honest with you, because when we sell it on the merchandise on tour, it's obviously a lot heavier.
The trouble is, I've found that when you go to the merch, you go in there early on when there's no queue and they've got full availability. But then do you want to carry around a 12-inch vinyl or you queue up right at the end and the vinyl's all gone?
That's the problem. You can't, you know... I mean, at the end of the day, you can't carry around thousands of LPs on tour because it'd just be ridiculous, wouldn't it?
But it's lovely to see. You'll be taking some vinyl out. Were you on the merch?
Yeah, we will do. Just get in early.
Get in early indeed. But yeah, no, it's nothing nicer than coming back with a bit of vinyl. Well, you can't beat the vinyl. I like the streaming services we've got now are convenient because you can just get, you know, virtually anything. But to actually hold a piece of vinyl in your hand, you've got the artwork and you've got, you know, the whole package and stuff.
It's the ritual, isn't it, of getting it out and putting it on the record player and putting the needle on it and then, you know.
Yeah. And I'm glad sort of young people are sort of getting back into it now.
Weird, isn't it?
Young cool people.
Because I live in Brighton and there's been a couple of record shops I've actually opened up. And, you know, when I've been in record shops in the last 20 years, it's been kind of middle-aged blokes. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
No, it's kids in there.
Yeah.
Like you say, people who are suddenly buying it. And it's not just new records, they're buying kind of classic old records as well.
And the nice thing as well, I think they're starting to, a lot of young people have started sounding like a dinosaur. A lot of young people, they're sort of starting to realise the importance of listening to an album as well, which is that's the worst thing I think about streaming services is they cherry pick this track, that track, that track, and that's what they play, rather than listening to the album like your own albums, and they're put together in that order for a reason, and it's like you listen to the whole thing. It's like an artwork, so to then just pick one or two tracks, it's okay, but you should give the album a listen. I think they're starting to get that as well.
It's funny you should say that, because when we did the 24 song singles, obviously we were just kind of recording them randomly. Well, that'll do for the May one, that'll do for the June one. When it came to the album, actually kind of they're not in chronological order. Certain tracks sounded like the beginning of a side or the end of a side. And once you established that, then you thought, well, that one's, you know, this side's got too many fast ones on it. We should spread them. So, like you say, it's kind of put out, you know, like a full set almost of all these tracks.
Because I was interested in keep going on about the Hit Parade series, but the B-sides were all covers, weren't they, on that?
Yeah.
And I haven't heard I understand you did a cover of Shaft, Isaac Hayes. I haven't heard that. I'll have to check that one out.
That was a bit of a challenge. I mean,
some interesting B-sides,
You know, I'm not sure it completely worked, but...
well, I should hope not. Well,
you know, these four white kind of, you know, Yorkshire lads from Leeds.
Was it in a Leeds accent?
It was produced by Jimmy Miller, who was the Rolling Stones producer, if you remember.
Oh, really?
But he was the producer on some of those Hit Parade singles. So he did the kind of narration, shall we say.
That's
American. But,
you see, you cheated a bit then, really. You didn't have your voice on.
It wasn't going to be there. It sounded ridiculous, I think.
Oh, no, that sounds good. So recently as well, I understand you did an album of Bond covers. An album of Bond covers in 2020. Was it for a charity?
It was a benefits album for a charity called Calm, CALM. And you know, it goes along with the kind of love of John Barry in a way. I've always loved those kind of theme tunes and things. And
I've
always wanted to do one. We didn't really have time to do a wedding present one, so I just asked people with wedding present connections. So like Cinerama did one, and the Ukrainians actually do. We talked about before they did. Yeah. So it's like people I knew who all had a physical connection to the band, really. So, and that expanded a bit, quite a bit. I think that was a double LP in the end as well. But it was It was great.
That's great.
Amazing songs.
And that was 2020. So it was a strange time. Well, it's good that you used your time creatively over lockdown, because you had the Edge of the Sea Festival in Brighton. So is that your festival?
So yeah, it's a festival I do every year in August. I think we're doing the 13th one this year. So it started in 2009, and it's not a massive thing. It's just this venue in Brighton that I really like called Concord yeah. 2. Yeah, the Wedding Present play, Cinerama play, the Ukrainians have played, and it's just basically bands that I like. We couldn't do it obviously for 2 years because it was the pandemic the first year.
Yeah,
and then it was that pingdemic the second year.
But
yeah, that time went really weirdly, didn't it?
So I understand you did you recorded a set from your respective homes, the bands. So you did a lockdown and stripped back over in 2020. So yeah, so you still managed to do something.
Yeah, I mean, it just seemed like an obvious thing to do when we couldn't play live and we couldn't do the festival. And there's lots of little, I mean, there's some other stuff as well. We did the Bond LP, put that together. I also I finished volume one of my autobiography. I did that. It's in comic book form,
like a graphic novel sort of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we did volume one in 2020 and volume two last year.
And is it sort of wedding present? It's just a wedding present graphic novel.
Yeah, basically. Volume one is I talk about, it's basically my life story from being born up to the forming of the band, really. So it's more kind of stories of me growing up, and then volume two is kind of like the first single. I think that goes to about signing to RCA kind of time. So
yeah,
and we're working on volume three now.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing I love doing, but obviously it's finding the time to do it when you've got all these other projects. Like the
festival. Yeah, quite. There's so much going on.
It's there in the background bubbling away, and I think we'll probably look at releasing that one maybe next year, I guess. But yes, we did that, and the lockdown stuff that we just thought, it's strange how you can record at home nowadays, isn't it? You got your little laptop and you don't need a lot of stuff, really, and it was all acoustic and or semi-acoustic anyway, and we just recorded it on our computers and sent files to each other and added stuff.
And you did some stuff with Louise Wiener as well.
Well, that's because the current guitar player, John, who you mentioned before, John Stewart, is actually in Sleeper as well.
Right. Oh, I see.
So he played me this song that Sleeper never released called We Should Be Together. And I loved it, actually. And I thought we should do a cover of it.
Oh, great.
So we did like a wedding present version. And then I said, I think Louise would actually sing on it as a duet. And she agreed to. So we did it on the lockdown album. And then we did like an electric version. It was the first of the 24 song singles. Great that she did that, yeah.
So we're looking forward to seeing you at Colchester Arts Centre then, David. So you're looking forward to coming back to Colchester? I believe you've been to the Arts Centre a few times before.
Yeah, it's one of the venues I've probably played more than anywhere else, really. I've played there half a dozen times now or something, yeah.
It's great.
So I love it. I love Colchester Arts Centre.
Yeah, and it's nice being in a sort of a deconsecrated church. Yeah, a really interesting venue.
It's got that kind of good mix of good production values, the people are nice, the sound's good, the lights are good, and yet it's a small place. So people feel like it's an intimate concert as well, which is great, I think.
Fantastic stuff there from David Gedge from The Wedding Present. And thank you once again to Dance at Dave. There are still some tickets available, but they won't hang around long. So get down to the box office or get online, because it's going to be a treat. And now it's over to the Art Centre Director, Mr. Anthony Roberts, Dr. Anthony Roberts, and one of his fabulous tales.
I was at my computer when I found myself clicking a link that promised me pictures of what celebrities from yesteryear look like today. I didn't even know which celebrities would be revealed in their presumably gnarled and decrepit state, but still I clicked. Clickbait, that's what it's called. Now, if you'd have asked me what clickbait was when I came to Essex in 1991, my best guess would have been that it was the honey trap that anglers use to lure a click. And a click was some type of freshwater fish found amongst the sweeping fens of East Anglia. No doubt a Wikipedia search would have revealed that the click inhabits the hidden gullies and waterways of this region, existing adjacent to the native breeds of tench and bream. But hang on, Wikipedia in 1991? I don't think so. It would have been the heavy tomes weighing down the shelves in the public library to which we would have turned for answers. Good old Encyclopedia Britannica. And since the internet came along, a whole new language has evolved. Way back then, surfing meant taking a waterboard to a distant beach, swimming into the sea with it, and then coming back again aboard said floating age. And very healthy it was too. It did not mean staring point blank at a pixelated screen for 8 hours for no better reason than to find out what celebrities look like today, which is not quite so healthy. In pre-internet days, my own personal inbox was something entirely different. A cookie was something I ate with my cup of tea, and downloading was something I did alone in a locked room after a heavy meal. My whole clickbait journey was entirely disheartening anyway. After screeds of adverts, I found myself staring at some poor crumbled actress who had, apparently, once been a star of EastEnders. And since I gave up watching EastEnders after Dirty Den left, the shock effect was a little lost on me. The poor crumpled actress did look a bit dishevelled, it's true, but even so, I'm prepared to bet she looks a whole lot better than Leslie Grantham, the actor who played Dirty Den, who I'm guessing isn't looking too pretty now since he died in 2018. The clickbait industry is getting ever smarter as we unwittingly reveal more and more of our tastes, habits, and lifestyle choices through online shopping or just simply by browsing the internet. What's really infuriating is when the algorithms conspire to spit out something you actually really like. Now, I'm a massive fan of the 1950s American sitcom Sergeant Bilko, which is a fairly niche market by anyone's standard and something I don't shout about. So when I was scrolling through Facebook and an advert popped up suggesting I could buy a Sergeant Bilko t-shirt, I was both appalled at how technology had managed to invade my psyche to the extent of knowing this obscure detail in my taste in comedy, and at the same time excited to see the t-shirt, which I then bought for $15.99. The process began with a type of how dare you indignation, followed almost immediately by fascination with what they were offering. Infuriating. In my family, I always understood it was my older brother who was the smart one. I never guessed that the telephone, sitting there all innocent in the corner of the room, would turn out to be smarter than him and me put together. And what innocent objects that surround us now will turn out to be evolution's winners in the years ahead. Smartphones, smart cars, smart houses. But it's always the ones you least suspect, though, isn't it, that turn out to be the real threat. If I were you, I'd be a lot more wary around that innocuous-looking bread bin in the weeks ahead. By 2060, they could have taken over, and we could well be living in a world of bread bin totalitarianism.
And thank you there to Dr. Roberts and that rather splendid tale. And that just leaves me to say thank you very much for listening in to the Colchester Arts Centre Never Knowingly Understood podcast. The next one will be out on May the 20th. If you want to listen again, you can listen to it via the website, or you can go on to Con Radio every Sunday evening at 8 p.m. and that's on Colne 106.6, or indeed you can pop along to Mixcloud and you can hear a full version, including music. Anyway, thanks, and we'll see you again next month.